Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by a couple of gals who are feeling a tad bit starstruck by our guest lineup today. Anyways, we are your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. And today we are talking about AI on trial, the impact of deep fakes in the courtroom. This is another one of our foul play topics. Our new series for 2025, if you haven't caught on yet, is Foul Play, F-O-W-L. And we're so excited to have some amazing guests today. But before we dive in, how are you doing? What are your thoughts about 2025, Angie?
Personally, I am super excited. I don't really do New Year's resolutions, but I got this new planner and it had me sit down and think about like what my values are as a person. And so I spent an inordinate amount of time doing that over the holidays. And I feel very grounded going into the new year, which feels great.
That's very responsible of you. I'm so proud.
I got to balance out the irresponsible stuff, right? So,
well, before we really chatter on too much more about 2025 and all of our aspirations, I think maybe we should introduce our guests.
I would love to. So we are joined by two very special guests today. We are joined by the Honorable Ralph Artigliere and Ralph Losey. We got two Ralphs for you. So let me introduce them. Our first guest is Ralph Losey, a pioneer in e-discovery and a thought leader in the intersection of law and technology. As the creator of the widely respected and very fun eDiscovery Team blog and author of numerous works on digital evidence, Ralph has been instrumental in shaping how legal professionals approach AI, deepfakes, and the evolving rules of evidence. With decades of experience on complex cases, he's here to help us navigate the challenges posed by deepfakes in the courtroom. And before I welcome Ralph, I'm going to introduce our second Ralph, the Honorable Ralph Artigliere. Our second guest is the Honorable Ralph Artigliere, a retired judge and renowned educator in evidence law. Judge Artigliere's career includes years of presiding over complex civil cases and a continued focus on training legal professionals to meet modern challenges. With his expertise in judicial processes and adapting to technological advancements, we are so excited to hear his perspective on the impact of deepfakes in legal proceedings. Without further ado, welcome Ralph Losey. Welcome Honorable Ralph Artigliere. We are so happy to have you.
It's great to be here. Just great.
Yeah, ditto to that from the not so honorable Ralph.
I mean, you're going to really have to pay attention to the voices here because there's so many Ralphs.
we'll try to sound different anyway.
If one of you could adopt a British accent, that might help. Before we dive into our topic today, I do want to offer a quick disclaimer to our listeners. The views that we express here today are the eDiscovery Chicks and our guests' views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. This podcast is available solely for educational purposes, to provide general information about e-discovery principles, and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. And with all the lawyerly stuff out of the way, I think we can dive in now.
Let me just chime in. Our opinions aren't necessarily what our opinions will be tomorrow, and they're not the opinions of, in my case, a law firm I'm still practicing, or any of my clients, and I'm sure retired judge Ralph has the same kind of disclaimer.
So. So this is the first that we've had our guests have their own disclaimers too. So
does that mean we're getting really official, Bree?
We are super official. So we were just talking about it being 2025 and ringing in a new year. So this question is for the Ralphs. We, Angie and I, like to think of a word or a phrase to kind of coin for a new year. Like, perspective was my word last year. I hoped to have some balancing perspective and some new perspectives in my career in 2024. And I think I achieved that. But if you were to come up with a word or a phrase or a thought for 2025 for yourself, for your own personal goals, could you share what that might be?
Yeah, I'm going to continue to try to help folks dive into AI because, you know, I think it's coming at law and lawyers and judges really fast, and they're having a tough time with the transition. So I want to do everything I can to help with that.
That is much appreciated for sure.
I would say dig in, you know, keep on going. Don't give up. Keep on doing what you're doing.
I like that. So we're going to get you a t-shirt that says dig in on the front, I think.
My daughter is very into construction vehicles, so we have a lot of dig related puns in our house right now. Oh, I'm happy to hook you up with a t-shirt with some sort of construction vehicle.
I can dig it coming from a chick. That's amazing.
Oh, look, chicks can dig it too.
Chicks can dig it. Yes.
I like that. Well, our mission here at the eDiscovery Chicks is to bring complex, nuanced issues to people of all levels of expertise. We like to start with the basics today. This kind of goes out to either one of you that wants to answer it. But what do we mean by deep fakes and why are they so troublesome in court?
You want to go ahead?
Yeah, I think I'll start because then Ralph can correct me and, you know, give me, tell me where I was wrong. I mean, basically deepfakes are, I mean, they're synthetic media, images, videos, or audio, and they all have their own particular issues with them, but they're manipulated or generated using artificial intelligence. In the case that we're talking about now, it's with deep learning techniques as well, which can create highly realistic and indistinguishable content. You can swap faces in video, or you can make someone say something that they didn't actually say. You can create all kinds of problems with that, both in society and in the courts, because obviously truthfulness in the courts is so essential to justice. Ralph, do you have any perspective on deepfakes?
Well, I'll go to the second part of their question as to why they're so troublesome in court. You know, what's the big deal here? And kind of set up, we're going to talk a little bit about the rules, and particularly Rule 403, which I heard, Angie, you mention in your excellent podcast on the presentation step in EDRM. And that is the business about a prejudice, even though something is relevant. Also, the studies coming out of psychology and evidence. Both of us have been studying trial psychology and how to persuade people for a long time. And it turns out that video and audio, but particularly video, has a profound impact upon jurors and judges. Even though you can instruct a jury, disregard that evidence, and you know, we have sustained the objection. Well, they've heard the video. I mean, we're talking like studies are showing it has 800 times greater impact on a person than testimony. And so a video is very dangerous, can be very prejudicial if it's not accurate. And so this is a problem for the courts, that who's going to decide if something is authentic, and to put it in the jury's hands is a dangerous thing, just because we're all human beings. We're not AIs yet that can just disregard everything. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's particularly troublesome. And it's why, you know, we're out here trying to get some changes made in the rules and to alert our friends in the bar and in the judiciary as to how important it is to make sure that deep fakes do not prejudice or taint the trial, so we can, you know, all try and get a fair trial.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm super grateful to both of you that you're doing that. We just had in our first Foul Play episode a guest who talked about phones and using your phones to find your geolocation. And in that episode, we talked about, well, first of all, in a criminal, you know, matter, we're going to look at the video, because the video is going to show you who was there or who wasn't there or whether or not they did the crime. But if we can't depend on the video, then we will default to the phone. And so just to prove up what you were just saying, Ralph, is we look at video as the truth. We look at that as, well, if I can see it, if I can feel it, if I can hear it, if it makes sense, then I believe it. And it's hard as a person. I don't even know if me being a somewhat intelligent person, if I could even break the bias of, well, I just saw that. Is it real or is it not? Is it believable evidence or is it not? So great, great points there.
Yeah. Well, and Bree, I think that touches on something that I was just about to ask Ralph, because during your answer, you used the term prejudice. And I want to call that out because it's a term of art within the legal community. So this is a jump ball for either Ralph. Can you explain what the term prejudice means specifically within the context of Rule 403 and how that applies to deepfakes?
Hey, Angie,
the judge handled that one.
Take it. Angie, I've heard you describe prejudice. I mean, any evidence that hurts your case is prejudicial, right? The question really is, when does the impact of that evidence become so out of value or beyond the value of the potential that it might not be real? You know, that's the Rule 403 dilemma that we present to judges. And it's a subjective thing that judges are hesitant to use to rule out evidence. But it's going to be so important as we discuss this topic, because unfortunately, the other rules that we have on authenticity are not sufficient to deal with all of the situations that you might have. Because I mean, if you have just about any situation that occurs nowadays, somebody's got an iPhone and they're going to take a video of it, whether it's, you know, January 6th with all of the video that they had, official and unofficial, of what went on there, or if it's an accident scene, or if it's something, if an affray occurs and somebody takes a video of what one person did to another person and how they did it, that all comes in. And the problem with these fakes is that, and you have the deep fakes, which can be intentionally manipulated. Then you have what are called shallow fakes, which is manipulation that doesn't rely on machine learning, but on the iPhone itself. If you, for example, pinch it and open it up a little bit, it can create something that's a little different, because in that phone, there's something to make something look good that doesn't look good. So it tries to alter things. And back a few years ago, the Kyle Rittenhour case, where he was claiming self-defense and that somebody had a gun pointed at him, they took a surveillance video from an iPhone, or not surveillance, but an iPhone video, and just used the iPhone to manipulate it. And the judge was at a loss what to do with it, because you couldn't tell whether that manipulation by the phone actually represented what really happened, what was really there. Was the gun pointed in that direction, or whether it represented what the phone was changing it to, you know, which was different from what actually happened. So you've got shallow fakes that also come to play. Whether it's a deep fake or a shallow fake, the judge is going to be the gatekeeper. And so prejudice is going to be the fallback position when science and circumstantial evidence and other things do not answer the question for you.
Cheap fakes are what they say. They're not very good. They're cheap. Anybody can get them. You see them all the time. The other thing is the difference between a fake. Now we're talking evidentiary and courtroom. A fake that one person is claiming, and here we get the deep fakes, is claiming is real. And another person is saying, no, it's not. That's not really me. That's not it. That's one kind of fake. It has an evidentiary issue. But the other kind of fake is one side says, yes, of course, we used AI to enhance it, to show the gun more clearly. There's no question that we used it. They admit it's, quote, fake. They say it's AI used to enhance. So that's an admitted fake situation. And there you get into the other side saying, yep, you enhanced it, but you changed it, and it's now prejudicial or it's misleading. And that's the Washington case example, where the court takes a look at it and they say, your expert didn't explain it enough and it's not convincing, so we're not going to prohibit the admission of the video, which everybody, the first video, because that was not questioned, but we are going to prohibit the enhanced version. Like you all see in CSI where they zoom in and now suddenly the 10 pixels show a detailed face. Well, that you got to prove. And so those are two totally different things, trial and evidentiary wise, is that the, you know, challenged fake where one side says, you know, you're a liar, that's not real. And the fake that, well, I just enhanced it and I did a good job of enhancing it. And the other side says, no, you didn't.
Well, thank you for that distinction, both of you. When did deepfakes start appearing, and in what context? Just kind of going back to the basics here.
Well, it's interesting. It first started in 2017 by a Reddit user. By the way, Reddit's been completely scanned by all of the, now the AI, Gen AI users. So it's all in the deep mind thinking about stuff. But back in 2017 by a user in Reddit, you can create your own names. And this user's name was Deep Fake. And he was the first person. Yeah, how original. A giveaway, you know, what are you doing here, guys? So, but So he made it, and, you know, unfortunately, porn often drives a lot of this. And it was a doctored porn of a famous celebrity, Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman, and, you know, superimposed her face on it. And this was not by using any kind of fancy AI. This was, you know, Final Cut and just knowing how to edit it and doing a very clever job of it, but it still qualifies. A deepfake doesn't have to be AI, but the danger now is that AI is getting so good at it that even, you know, a super techie like this deepfake guy, he was one of the few people that could do it. It was the first one to kind of demonstrate in a dramatic way. And then, you know, then he proceeds to do other celebrities. Reddit, I think, took about a year, but they banned all of this. And now it's banned on most, you know, all social media sites as I know of, although some of them it still is there, but temporarily, if they find out about it, they will remove it. But at the time, you know, it was brand new. So that's when it first started in 2017. And then it quickly moved to satire and spoof fakes. And the famous one was President Obama, you know, saying funny things. So, you know, he is Mr. Proper. If he says anything wrong, you know it's a fake. Because the worst thing he ever did is wear a tan suit.
Horror. I mean,
yeah, the horror of it. So, you know, there were things put out in 2018 on that. And I'll tell you one I just learned about, coming out of Canada. We should have shared this with the Canadian people. But about that same time, there was a equivalent of a attorney general in Canada, in Alberta, a guy named Jonathan Dennis. And he was doing and they were showing videos of him in what American-wise we call kind of a black face. But it was actually a face that... to look like performing a caricature of an indigenous person in Canada, making fun of the Native American Indians and what they look like. You know, he was doing it in a conference call and they had that. And at first he comes on and he says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize. It was all in good fun, you know." And then more of this card started coming out where a bunch of the Canadian politicians and lawyers, and including attorney generals of the area and stuff, were at parties and they're all doing this. That was the rage back then and make fun of them with telling stuff. Long story short, later on, he changes his mind. He stops apologizing. He says, "Those were deep fakes." And last year, 2023, he got a court in Canada to make a ruling, a declaration that video in fact was a deep fake. And the Canadian court did it based on an affidavit from an expert, uncontested, no counter expert, who opined, "Yes, I've looked at this and you know, this was a deep fake." And so the court issued the ruling that he wanted, thinking people wouldn't remember that he admitted it, at least part. But wow. Interesting thing, Ralph, you'll enjoy this. This same guy, now practicing attorney, was just sanctioned by the bar in Canada just this year in 2024 for conflict of interest violations. And we all see this in people that, you know, so he is getting his due, apparently. That's on appeal by the Bar Association in Canada. But so, yeah, there's that as well. And, you know, I can go on, and I do want to talk a little bit about, and I'll get on my soapbox, but let me pause for a minute because, you know, as a father and a grandfather, I feel strongly about this misuse of the fake porn and how it is, you know, studies are showing it's like 96% or more of the deep fake videos out there are porn videos. And almost all of those are against women.
Porn and First Amendment law often go hand in hand. I feel like porn has influenced a lot of jurisprudence in that area. And so what are you seeing at the intersection of porn, First Amendment law, and deepfakes?
Well, yeah, I'm interested in First Amendment law as well. I live in Florida. So, you know, the interesting thing, and I never much liked it, but it used to be that fake animated child pornography was not illegal and was protected. And that is now all being rethought. A lot of people believe it is not, because it's now, you know, will not be. I believe if it goes up again in the Supreme Court, it will be found to be porn and not protected by the First Amendment. I'm personally not dissatisfied with that because I, you know, that is the most disgusting thing. And like I say, as a father and grandfather, you know, I think that the other court went too far in protecting rights of First Amendment to show children that look real, but they're not, to show them being abused, which I thought was going too far. Now, there's grayer areas in the middle, and there is totally synthetic adult porn, you know, that it, there is no real person's head on there. And, you know, I don't have really an opinion on that, but I do have a strong opinion about, and I believe I can predict safely that the courts are gonna reverse themselves on that. And, you know, this is one time when I'd say, you know, good.
Well, I think the broader question is not just porn, but satire and, you know, First Amendment rights of people, for example, for political comment and so forth. And I mean, with memes being such a high profile thing these days about in politics and so forth, you're going to see a lot more of that kind of use. And that's kind of a blurry situation, you know, that you do have to be concerned about First Amendment and the, you know, whether somebody's sort of fair game because of their public status and so forth. But, it, you know, as a former judge and, you know, as a grandfather as well, I see no basis at all for supporting any kind of child porn or actually, you know, revenge porn or any of those things. I think that you're not going to have a First Amendment basis when somebody is harmed in that way. That's different than satire. That's different than, you know, something that is on the edges of the First Amendment. So I agree wholeheartedly with Ralph. I mean, the not only the courts, but law enforcement are, you know, changing their views on that, and they're clamping down on it for good reason.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see more of this. You know, one of your question areas for us is, you know, where are we seeing this, and where are we going to see it? I don't think we've seen it yet, but we're going to see it soon, if not already. And that is plaintiff's lawyers, tort lawyers, bringing cases of so-called revenge porn for intentional infliction of emotional harm.
Yeah.
Invasion of privacy. Mm-hmm. These are torts, and they can trigger punitive damages. And young girls, you know, they're being really harmed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we need to step up to the plate and sue these bastards. I think that's going to happen.
Yeah. And the technical community is going to play a big role at helping get the justice done that needs to be done.
I totally agree.
Listeners who might not operate in this space, a tort is a civil action for damages based on an alleged harm. So it can be everything from, like, you got in a car crash and you sue the person who's at fault for the damages to your car and for any medical bills, or it can be like what Ralph was just talking about, where you sue someone, you know, for intentional infliction of emotional distress or defamation or, you know, any number of things. So I just wanted to provide that context.
Yeah.
And, you know, my wife's a mental health counselor, so I sort of get this through the back door. I mean, and these cause lifetime damages. There's one in the news now. If you Google deep fake, which I did this morning, there's a poor young girl. She was 15 at the time, and she posted a video of herself wearing a bathing suit, a bikini, online on Instagram. Perfectly innocent, but that was taken then by people in the high school she had just started, and it was, quote, nudified, where it then created a fake nude of her, totally fake, but it looked real, and it was circulated all over high school, and she was brave enough to speak out, and, you know, she's, you know, on TV and stuff now. But for everyone brave enough like that to survive it, there's 99 more that are just ruined.
Right. So I know we're going to pivot this conversation towards authentication here in a moment. I just wanted to offer out to our listeners, we're talking about a lot of rules and laws, and we're about to talk about several articles. So I don't want you to feel stressed that you need to get out a pen and paper and write them all down, because we're going to make them available to you in our show notes for this show. So just sit back, relax, and enjoy, and we'll take care of the homework for you so you can refer back to your notes later.
Yes, Bri and I are both eldest daughters. We love homework. So let us do it. Brings us joy.
Yes.
All right. So Ralph Losey, this question's for you. In your article, The Problem of Deepfakes and AI-Generated Evidence, Is It Time to Revise the Rule of Evidence? Rules of Evidence, Part 1. You describe how deepfakes challenge the principles of evidence law, particularly regarding authenticity. And you highlight Rule 901's reliance on authentication through traditional methods. But, and I want to ask you more about your thoughts there, but let's start basic first. Can you explain the concept of authenticity in the evidentiary context and why it's so important?
Well, a thing is what you say it is. I hope all of your listeners will look up some YouTube videos of Judge Paul Grimm. And he does this famous thing of Popeye, I am what I am. I don't know if you remember that cartoon, but, you know, it's authenticating. And it's the easiest thing to do in the world to establish the burden here. It must produce evidence sufficient to support a finding that the item is what the proponent claims it is. That's to quote the rule. So if you say, this is an email I got from Angie, and you say that, you have then, and maybe give more information on it, you've authenticated. It's pretty low burden. Then if Angie says, no, I never sent that email, then you can trigger more of an evidentiary burden on it. And the thing about it is it's designed, the evidence rules, they haven't been changed in quite a while. It's not really designed for AI. And the problems we're having with the Rules Committee, you know, they're being lobbied hard now by Professor Grossman and retired Judge Grimm to change these rules and update it. And in my article, I go into it in excruciating detail. But, you know, there needs to be some adjustment to this old rule to take into the fact that we now have really good fake stuff. And it's way beyond the fake stuff that the law has dealt with before with fake signatures. That's really, and the committee is going off on, oh, well, we've taken care of fake signatures and fake handwriting. We can do it. Well, no, this is a level beyond. And although there are now plenty of products out there that claim to detect fake videos and faked audios, none of them are perfect. And if you go beyond the advertising and you look at the studies, you find that, well, they're 98% on this, but geez, on another thing, they're only 85%. And so there is no 100% foolproof yet. And it's kind of a spy versus spy thing. On the one hand, you've got the latest kind of deep fake video generators. On the other hand, you got the detectors. And it's kind of like red teaming in cybersecurity. The attacker, in this case, the defrauder, always has a little bit of an advantage because they're leading the way. Well, I got a new method to create something fake. So it's an area where we're going to need some clarification on the role of experts. We're going to need clarification in the procedural rule to prevent this harm of having court, a judge, just throw it all to the jury in a situation where we say, hey, that's real, and the accused attorney general who says, no, it's fake. and have it more resolved by the judge, who is the one that deals with expert testimony, and have set up pre-hearings. And that's what the article goes into. We need to adjust this so that the court, the judge, deals with the expert issues on it. The court has the opportunity of a special hearing on this, rather than just dumping it at trial on jurors or on anybody, you know, dumping it on the judge at trial. These are special issues. They're more difficult. They need to be heard in advance of the trial. They need to have things set out and give the judge an opportunity to think it over. And then we need to have the judge make the decision because of this psychological effect that I've told you about. Now, judges are human too, but they've been prepared and briefed by this, and I gotta think that they're more disciplined about this sort of thing because they do it every day, to disregard it, and would have a better chance of doing it than the poor man and women on the street that get hauled into jury duty that don't know, they're not trained in limiting their knowledge in evidentiary matters. They're just thrown into a room and they don't really know what's going on. And, you know, the brief example that Professor Grossman always gives, which I love it, and that is you show a video of a card game to people that are playing the game, and you come back and say, hey, look at this video we found. Looks like one of your people was cheating. And then they show them a fake video of the card game they were just playing, and it's fakely showing somebody taking a card out of their pocket. And then you get them talking about it, and like, half of the people will claim, oh yeah, I saw that. I saw that. Yeah, I knew he was cheating. And they were there, you know? And so somebody's not there. What chance do they have? So it's the profundity and the impact of seeing something or hearing something I mean, and you can go to my website and hear videos that I say on there, AI, you know, they're fake, but I can't tell the difference of the fake video on my own voice. They're that mm-hmm. good. I couldn't mm-hmm. tell you, was that me or not? And yet the rule is subsection, and this is all 901-901-5, opinion about a voice. I'm quoting it. Says an opinion identifying a person's voice, whether heard firsthand, like kind of we're doing now, or through mechanical or electronic transmission or recording. That's how old these words are. In other words, they heard it on a tape recorder or whatever. But just based on hearing the voice at any time under circumstances that connect it to the alleged speaker, like people listening to me now or listening to Angie and you know, Bree, and that if they hear that voice again, they say, oh, yeah, I recognize her voice. That's good enough to get it in. And then when you read the comment, the official notes, you know, that carry a lot of weight, they actually say that oral voice identification is not a subject of expert testimony. Well, come on. There's plenty of experts that'll, I mean, I know enough of it. You can do spectrum analysis and you can see how the high notes and people's voices do. And it is a matter of expert testimony. The rules don't even reflect that. So they need to be brought up to date. And that's just a couple of examples.
I'd like to talk about the practical issue for judges that with Rule 901 and for all of us in our courts. We can't all afford experts to look at these things. I mean, these things occur in small cases and large cases. They occur in domestic violence cases. They occur in divorces, especially family law cases where people's emotions are very high. You have a high chance that somebody's going to try to do something to the other side that's pernicious. You know, he sent me that text, or she did this to my computer, or whatever they might do, or here's a picture of her doing this when with the kids. These are all kinds of things that can occur. And also in the employment law realm, there's a, you know, Montefiore case where someone was claiming sexual harassment, and there was an issue about a text message, and she had a picture or screenshot from a phone that alleged that had been manipulated. I mean, it was ultimately proven that it had been manipulated and tried to introduce that. That's where you're getting it. In that case, the Montefiore case in the Southern District of New York, they could afford, the defense could afford, because it was a corporation, could afford an expert. And that expert helped them unpack the situation. It couldn't have been done on this particular iPhone. You know, her story of how it was done, how she did this screenshot didn't wash with the actual facts, and they were able to unravel it, and the expert testimony helped with that. Well, what if you can't afford the expert, you know, to come in and deal with that? So that's the 901 dilemma that courts are facing, and that's where the prejudicial value being outweighed by, you know, probative value being outweighed by the prejudicial value, Rule 403 comes in. And the case that Ralph was talking about, the Washington case, State versus Palooka, which involved, you know, an enhancement. It was an admitted fake, but you know, we enhanced this video of the accident to show this to the jury. Well, the person who did the enhancement in that case, the expert used a program that they weren't even really familiar with and couldn't really explain how the enhancement was done. And the defense had an expert that could debunk that. But then the judge said, well, you know, I have two experts, one saying showing this and another showing that. But I think that the prejudicial value of this outweighs the probative value. So I'm not going to allow the enhancement into the case. That was a case where there were two ways the judge could throw it out. Unfortunately, we're not always faced with the benefit of expert testimony, and the judges are going to be dealing with that. So, I mean, that's the practical end. And that's why Ralph and Maura Grossman and Judge Grimm feel the rules need to be changed. There are folks who are saying, well, we've had these rules forever, and we've had forgeries and fakes forever. So the same rules can be applied to these. Well, they can be, but they're not good at it. they're not good at resolving the problem. So shouldn't we get a rule that is better at doing that? And that's what Ralph writes about in the articles that you're going to post.
Yeah. And Ralph, I really have enjoyed reading your articles, by the way. But one thing that you have talked about is the difference between the forgery, the, you know, handwriting, you know, fraud or whatever, or counterfeit money, that sort of thing, versus AI deepfake. And the truth of the matter is that our AI engines and built into them is their own fraud detector. They're constantly scanning their own output to beat the fraud themselves. So we're seeing this move at a, you know, light speed, as opposed to counterfeit money doesn't move at a light speed. And yes, there were developments within money to authenticate it over time, but that was a long period of time. This is something that is just moving at such a pace that even finding the experts to help us authenticate, I think, is a really hard thing to do. I hope that our listeners will go back and read some of your articles. They're very insightful and offer up a lot of food for thought.
Okay, so where are you seeing AI pop up? Like, where are deepfakes hitting the courts?
Well, so this is a practitioner Ralph here. I mean, fraud in crime, in criminal law, that started back in 2019. The famous case originated with a poor British company that was a subsidiary of a German, larger German energy company, and the CEO called and directed a wire transfer of, you know, in US dollars, about $250,000, and it's £230,000 wire transfer. And the CFO, and he says, okay, and he's a couple of conversations with him. He recognizes the voice, and it was going to go to a third party supplier, nothing unusual about it. So he sends the wire, goes through, and the CIO comes back, says, well, you know, that was good. We need more money sent to the supplier. And so at that point, he started wondering. And well, it turns out it was totally bogus. And they did get away, never recovered, over $250,000. And this is in 2019, made the headlines. In the meantime, this has now become commonplace all the time. This happens on all levels, not just the $250,000. My wife's a nonprofit group got messed out of just, fake emails, faking directing, and they lost, $2,000. So somebody, some criminal in America or dark web someplace, you know, they're doing it every day, such that there's warnings out by everyone. I mean, the latest one, I don't know if you've heard it, is to look out for getting gifts. They come with QR codes on the gifts. So scan to find out who the gift, and it may come through a genuine Amazon account. You scan the QR code, boom, they've just broken into your phone that they used it to scan. So there's fraud everywhere, including in audios and in videos. I'd like to recommend a piece of advice. Get safe words with your family members. And that is only things, I mean, I've got a thing that if I really was, you know, God forbid, I was on the side of the road and needed money immediately, I would use the safe word, and nobody else would know the safe word and talking to my wife or family. And people mm-hmm. got to do this. You've got to set up protection against the ongoing barrage of fraud. And, you know, the criminals are just going crazy with this.
I like that advice. And Angie and I both have small children. And so it's a challenge these days to teach kids what's real, what's not. How do we trust it? How do we not? So that's a great piece of advice.
I'd like to sort of give the perspective of, you know, where you see these things in court, and judges are going to be dealing with it. As a state court judge, I mean, I sat on the domestic violence court when I was in family law, and they frequently hand their phone to you, you know, and say, this is what I just received. And even back in the day, you could have spoofing where somebody could spoof a text or an email from somebody. But you've got family law, you've got criminal cases where people are going to try to alter evidence. And you've got all kinds of civil cases where there is a tendency and I guess a feeling among people, I know I'm right in this case, and I just need something to prove it, and they'll make up their own evidence on it. It sort of harkens back to when I was a defense lawyer and I defended doctors and hospitals. We had to lock up the analog medical chart when we got a claim because of the tendency of people to want to fix the record, you know, something that they say actually happened, but you're not allowed to alter the medical records afterward. The reason that it's such a big deal and the reason we locked it up is it can hurt your case so badly if you do that, because once you do that, it's a problem. So fast forward to now, lawyers are going to need to be on their guard for clients giving them something that's too good to be true, you know, giving them the smoking gun evidence that wasn't really there maybe on the first go through and all your discussions and so forth. But once the client figures out what they need to do to prove their case, all of a sudden they have something that's too good to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at it that it's an all hands on deck situation to prevent this from happening. The first level, and whether it's on EDRM or whether you're a lawyer in an office interviewing clients or whatever, the first defense is the lawyer themselves, because they have an ethical obligation of candor to the court to not submit something into court that's false, that's fraudulent. The tick in there, and what Ralph was referring to earlier, the tick in the ethical rule is that you can't not present it to the court unless you know it's fake. You know, people can sort of say, well, I don't, you know, my client gives it to me, I have to assume they're right, that it's true. Well, that's not really true, because you have an ethical obligation not to present something that you should know is fake. I mean, through diligence and understanding what's going on. And that's the first line of defense. The important ethical part of that is you owe it to your client to not let them make that mistake. Because if the client commits a fraud on the court, their whole case can get thrown out. And mm-hmm. It could be a good case. I mean, they could lose a good case by trying to gild the lily and present that kind of evidence. So that's the first, on the all hands on deck, that's the first level. The second level is the opposing attorney. When they get something from the other side that's too good to be true, they need to look at it and say, could this be a fake? And if, you know, if they have the wherewithal, they get experts to look at it, or they can look at it. But I mean, basically, if it's a single piece of perfect evidence and there's no original and there's a complicated story on how it was created, like the gal in the Montefiore case who said she used her iPhone 10 for this screenshot and that screenshot couldn't be produced by that, there's going to be an issue in there somewhere. So you look at that, whether you're the lawyer presenting it or I'm the lawyer opposing it. And you look at all of the surrounding circumstances. And if you're the lawyer opposing it, you put the lawyer who's presenting it on notice, or the lawyer who gave you the evidence on notice, that this is fake. You need, or it could be fake. And then the onus is on them, a higher ethical onus, to check it out. Then it's not, I can just believe my client and present it. They have a higher ethic. Then the third line of defense is the judge. And, you know, once it presented to court, if you can't get agreement among the attorneys and it's still an issue, the judge has to be smart enough and capable enough to listen to everything and be the true gatekeeper and have the courage to make a decision on the thing. And it's not easy, but we're all hands are going to have to be on deck to prevent this from happening in court.
If I could chime in, you know, they normally, we don't let it go to the judge. You know, I used to be with a large employment firm, and we would see dozens of these fake things every year being produced to us. You know, I won't tell you if we ever had some being produced to the client, but we would check them. And you have a duty to check it. You can't just because your client says it's true. Mm-hmm. How many times does a client say 100% truth? Never. You can't be a lawyer and not realize that. They're not trying to lie, but their ability to remember things is limited, and we remember things the way we want. Anyway, when you find something that you think is too good to be true, it usually is not true. And if it's produced to you, number one, if you have videos produced to you, you need to look at them. You'd be amazed. I mean, oh, it's so hard to look at a video. You can't search videos, such or such. You need to do it. When you find something too good to be true, and they may try and bury it, there's no duty to say, hey, I got a smoking gun here. You need to look at it. So you do your job as a receiving party. You find the stuff and you look at it. You think it's wrong. Get an opinion of an expert. Hire the vendor. Just the initial opinion won't cost you that much. If you have to actually take it to the judge, which I'm going to tell you almost never happens, well, then it's going to cost $10,000 or more, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But just to take a look at it. And then when we find that, none of this, you know, a Matlock business, a surprise jury, Perry Mason, surprise Montreal, aha, you know, this is a fake. No, that's not how it works. 98% of the cases are settled anyway. Mm-hmm. Immediately when you got it, you call up your plaintiff friend. Hopefully you talk to them and you're not one of these people that I'll never talk to opposing counsel. I hate opposing counsel. And that, by the way, is unethical and unprofessional to have a relationship like that. So you gotta be able to call them and say, oh, you know, you got a problem here. We found something. This thing is fake. I'm sure you don't know about it. And probably he doesn't.
Yeah. Did you hear about the judge in Alabama that ordered opposing counsel to get lunch together?
Yep.
Yeah, I love it. We had a judge in Orlando, Judge Presnell, great judge. He ordered the lawyers to meet on the courthouse steps and play rock, scissors, stone rather than take their dumb disputes to them.
That's great.
Talk to you or get it. When what we have found is you put your cards on the table. Don't hold anything back. Give them the expert report. Show it to them. You know, subtly remind them, say, well, you know, They get that their license is on the line. Mm-hmm. And chances are, if they're a plaintiff's attorney in employment law, they're not dependent on one client like that. And they're worried about whether they'll get paid at all. They're not going to want to risk their reputation, their license, to have a fraud on the court. 95% of the time, that's it. They fold. They say, thank you. Basically, they may not actually thank you, but they're thinking that. And the case goes away. Or sometimes it just settles for nuisance value. There may be other merit to it. You may not know for sure. Try and resolve this right away with opposing counsel. Don't bother the poor judge with it. They may not have the same time. And they're not all as good as our Judge Ralph. I mean, and they're busy. And so, yeah, resolve this yourself and do your lawyerly stuff too. It's not all about experts. It's about, you know, where's the chain of custody? Mm-hmm. What are the witnesses? Have you seen what my witness says? You know, he was there and he was out of the country at the time. We can prove that. You can look at it yourself. He's given us, you know, whatever. So there's more than just experts. It's about doing your job and the evidence and put it on the table. Don't save it for trial because, you know, you may hit the judge on a bad day. He may have had a bad lunch and just don't want to deal with this. You know, let the jury deal with this crap. I don't want to deal with that and not realize what we were saying. Wait a minute. Don't let the jury do it, Judge. They can't disregard it. We do get a lot of bites at the apple, but don't wait to and put all your money on the judge at the end.
In last year, 2024, Angie and I focused our series on the EDRM. The reason why is because we all, like you guys know, we lean heavily on that EDRM model to explain the workflow, the processes involving e-discovery. Angie and I are also both on the EDRM 2.0 committee, where we're rethinking the EDRM model and how that needs to maybe look different in the future. But I'm curious, Your Honor, where in the EDRM process does AI, deep fakes, cheap fakes, shadow fakes, whatever fakes you want to say, where does that play a part?
I would say it plays a part all the way through because, I mean, you're going from the initial analysis all the way to presentation. And unfortunately, these things can fly under the radar in evidence. It could be anywhere in the process that they come up. One of the things that I think is most important is to have everybody have their radar ready for this stuff anywhere through the process. As Ralph said, a lot of times people can sort of hide this stuff. I mean, it may be part of a large amount of data that you have to deal with, but it'll at some point, it's going to pop up as the smoking gun. And when it does, you need to be prepared to deal with it. We need to make everybody aware of this. I mean, I think that lawyers need to be aware of it. Judges need to be aware of it. Just this week, the Illinois Supreme Court issued a policy on artificial intelligence. And I, you know, the first two paragraphs of it are really good, but it says the integration of AI with the courts is increasingly persuasive and pervasive, offering potential efficiencies and improved access to justice. However, it raises critical concerns about authenticity, accuracy, bias, and the integrity of court filing, proceedings, evidence, and decisions. Understanding the capabilities and limitations of AI technology is essential for the Illinois judicial branch. And I say, bravo, that's good. The Illinois courts will be vigilant against AI technologies that jeopardize due process, equal protection, or access to justice. Unsubstantiated or deliberately misleading AI-generated content that perpetuates bias, prejudice, or obscures truth-finding and decision-making will not be tolerated. So if I'm a Illinois lawyer and I'm having the conversation that Ralph talked about with the other attorney or the conversation with the judge or arguing it, I'm going to be pulling out this policy and saying, look, we all have to be concerned about this. And this is my way of dealing with it. You know, you've got to understand, judge, that this is fake. This is undermining our entire process. And lawyers in civil court, only a small percentage actually get to trial. So you've got mediators that you have to educate, arbitrators that you have to educate, and lawyers who are negotiating their case, and clients have to understand the situation as well. So education is such a key component of this, which is why I'm so glad to be on here with y'all getting at the message. This is really good.
Thank you so much for that. And I agree. And I appreciate both you and the other Ralph for your efforts in educating us. We're going to ask you guys to give us your final thoughts here in a moment. Before we do, I actually wanted to ask Ralph Losey. You talked a lot about in a recent YouTube video about the liar's dividend. I was wondering, and you seem to kind of coin that phrase a bit in your discussion. And so I was hoping that you would expand upon that a bit. But I think the thing that's shocking to me and that was an educating thought, maybe I just hadn't thought about it in this way, is that when we are dealing with AI deepfakes, we're not only questioning the authenticity of the AI deepfake itself, now we're impacting the authenticity of video that is being used as legitimate evidence that is real video. We're actually also impacting that in the courtroom. Did you want to speak at all about the liar's dividend?
Well, first of all, I'd be a liar if I didn't tell you I didn't think of that. I mean, that phrase has been around quite a while. You know, I like it. It's a good phrase. Listen, it's been used by fraudsters for a long time. We're just seeing it now in video. I mean, you know, if you lie all the time and basically you just say, oh, no, the other person's lying. And you know, then, but that's what trials are about. I mean, if there wasn't a dispute of fact, why would there be a trial? It'd just be summary judgment or it'd just be declaration of law. So, you know, all litigators are used to having one side or the other is lying. You can be nice about it, say not recalling correctly, and it may be, but sometimes you have intentional liars, and we're used to that. And any good, you know, my specialty in the law was always fraud. So I'm used to dealing with fraudsters and looking for ways to reveal them. So it's not really new, the liar's dividend, but it's really been, I think, emphasized lately. For instance, the January 6th insurrection, the trials in D.C., point you to a great article by an excellent e-discovery expert judge too, Judge Herbert Dixon, senior judge in the Superior Court of District of Columbia. He's the guy for the ABA on technology. He wrote a great article, The Deep Fake Defense, an Evidentiary Conundrum. This is June of just this year. And in it, he talks about how almost all of the defendants, the evidence against them were videos. Here you are hitting a police officer. Here you are breaking a window. Here you are doing a, here's the video. And the FBI was collecting all of this and they had video evidence. All of them came into court and said, no, that's me. That's a deep fake. And all of them, that didn't work. The judges said, no, you can't just come into trial and make that allegation. So a smart judge, and these were smart judges, and they could tell it's just BS. It's just that was the only defense that they have, and it's a non-defense. You got to do more than that. And I think that's where we're going with the committee when they revise the rules, just to make that clear. And it's already there in 901. You have to create a justiciable issue here. You can't just say deep fake. You know, it may work in a jury, but it's not going to work with a sophisticated judge who hears this all the time. That's why you don't let that go to a jury just because somebody says it's a deep fake. What's your evidence that it's a deep fake? You know, criminal defense lawyers are going to be retaining more and more experts. corporate lawyers, people that have serial litigants. That's mainly who I represented in my career. And the lawyers you work with, you had better have experts on call. You'd better know, you know, who your experts are, what vendor, a lot of e-discovery vendors, it's part of what they do, analysis and authenticity and forensics. This is now more and more forensics experts are branching out, teaching themselves about this. Because don't think, you know, this is all I do is research and write this stuff. Don't think you can just learn about deep fakes in your spare time, spend a couple hours talking to lawyers. Hire yourself an expert that spent hundreds of hours, that's seen many of these cases. Get their advice. Participate in, you know, the collaborative approach that I know both of you, Bree and Angie, understand and promote here. And get your experts lined up to help you understand, help you prove the issues if it is a deep fake. Because, you know, you have to be prepared. What if a judge exercises discretion under 403, says, no, it's just prejudice. Maybe that judge is prejudiced. And because that's why we have appellate court. So establish your record, get your evidence in there. You know, we can't let judges just rule the reins without at least having a second level of review. Expert testimony is going to be required. Now, I realize that the vast majority of the lawsuits in this country, you can't really afford good attorneys. You can't afford good experts. A lot of pro se stuff going on out there, and a lot of attorneys that have never seen a technology case and they're having to do it. At least try and get some experts on there. Do the best you can to bring this to the judge's attention right away is our best advice, because this is not going away and it's going to get worse and worse. And get ahead of the curve now while you can.
Excellent advice. So I know we've reached the end of our time together. Thank you both for being here again. We've really appreciated you taking the time to chat with us and with our listeners. Your articles and previous webinars that you've both participated in have been widely talked about in our community, and it's something that we're all eager to learn more about. So thank you for being here to share your expertise with us. In line of parting thoughts, Your Honor, what would be your final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think anybody who's listening to this podcast will be the type of person who's going to have an impact beyond themselves. We're encouraging them to learn about it, but they're going to need to spread the word to others as well. I mean, that's the way this community works. The e-discovery community is amazing in the way it shares information and techniques and capabilities with others. More than any other legal community that I know, and I've known a lot of them over the years. So, I mean, a lot of times people are close to the best, but in the e-discovery community, we seem to want to share with each other the things that are going to make justice better. I'm very optimistic that as pernicious and as difficult as this issue is, we're going to get it taken care of as a legal community, and it's going to be in large part because folks come together and discuss these things and work on them and find solutions and then share them with others.
I love that. Ralph Losey, what about your parting thoughts?
Well, I kind of want to hit you with the granddad's concern and maybe point you to a report I just discovered today. It's a company, I think, in the Netherlands. It's called Sensity, Sensity.ai. And they have a new report just came out on their statistics on this, the Deepfake Report 2024. And so I had time for GPT to analyze it and summarize it for me. I recommend you do the same, Sensity.ai. But, you know, I checked around to and verify their claim that 96% of deepfake videos are sexually explicit and are about women. And they did not consent to the creation of this content. And this deepfake pornography is used to humiliate and harass women. And this is something that we all need to stand up against. I would urge parents to be careful. You know, look at what your daughters are doing. Look at what your sons are doing too. Know what how they're using their phone. Should you give a 14-year-old child an iPhone just to use unsupervised? And yeah, unfortunately, we had a suicide recently come out of a claim being talked into by an AI into doing it. And the poor kid was confused, and a lot of children are confused, and suicide is a real problem. And so, yeah, know what you're doing. Monitor what your children are doing. and look out for places like 4channel, a dark web place that people hang out on. Know about this. Learn that there are, that all the internet is not policed. And, you know, a lot of the provider content is policed, but there's very little law out there. This is all self-governance. There's a law in Tennessee called the Elvis Law that is the only one in the country that I know of now that makes providers liable. There's a bipartisan bill pending in Congress since the summer, the deep fake bill to outlaw, but even it doesn't make providers liable, but it clarifies that people who do this are liable. So this is a significant problem of our time, is the misuse of AI to create deep fakes. And I'm all about AI. Read my blog. I'm promoting people to use it, but you need to be aware of the dangerous side of AI. And this is probably the most dangerous side, not only in court, but just to our own well-being.
Great. Well, thank you both so much, Your Honor. Thank you for being with us. Ralph Losley, thank you for being with us. We've appreciated so much your expertise, your willingness to share it with our listeners, and all of the wisdom that you've imparted today.
Well, thank you
for having us.
Listeners, thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you've learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun along the way. Don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram, and check out our website, ediscoverychicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Catch us next time. Until then, flock on, friends.
Bye.
Bye.